Okay, it's 9 o'clock. More people will be coming on, but I want to start because there's a lot I want to do today. I just have a couple things to mention, then I'm going to show you a little video, and then we'll get right into Eliezer Berkovits. The first thing I want to do is I want to thank Bill Gewirtz for correcting what I said last week. I had spoken about Ramosha Feinstein and adding, and I his response about whiskey. And I described it as if it was the case that was spoken a lot about a couple of years ago, where it's in these casings or castings, whatever they call them. But that Bill pointed out that it's not true. He's talking about adding actual wine, and that is correct. It's in Yoredeia, Volume 1, Number 62 to 64. It deals with, I guess you'd call it blended scotch or whiskey or something like that. There was a company in the United States. Well, Riptides asked him whether you had this whiskey, I think from Kentucky, in which they actually added in a wine or brandy. And, I mean, they actually did it. It was part of the procedure. Exactly what the Rashba says you can't do. And Ramosha says it doesn't matter. It's still bottle. And it's not just bottle b'shishim. It's bottle 1 and 6. And, again, we're not talking about a case where we're unsure. Maybe it's a doubt. We're talking about something where or whether it's in the casings and it might have some extra wine in there. Ramosha was talking about a case where you knew that the company producing this whiskey was adding in the wine or brandy. So thank you, Bill, for pointing that out. A couple of people asked me about Ruchaim Zimmerman. Let me correct. I gave the wrong date, by the way. He died in 1995. And as I said, he was a bit of an interesting person, not a typical Rosh Hashiva. He didn't wear white, as I said. He wore sport jackets. He wore colored shirts. I found online that he even drove a Cadillac convertible, and he was clean-shaven. Not your typical Rosh Hashiva. I have a text here in which he speaks about Zionism. Let me just read you the part of it. When you wouldn't be surprised, he's attacking the left-wingers, the secularists, their vision of Zionism. But then let me just read you one paragraph where he's speaking about how we have to define Zionism. He says, for example, to the Naturei Karta or the Frumakkes, that's Frumakkes, of some Russia yeshivot in the yeshiva, or those living in B'nai Brak, the word Zionism alludes to apikorsin, kfira, and rejection of Torah. To these societies, even like the Chafetz Chaim, that is, if he come, such a tzaddik will come out for Israel and proclaim the significance of Eretz Yisrael, he will be branded immediately as a Zionist and will be identified with heathenism and against Torah, despite the fact that the Yerushalmi and Chagiga calls every Jew Tzion, and the Jewish nation as a whole is called Zion. And he goes on to say that by definition, to be Jewish is to be a Zionist, because you support the land of Israel and the importance of living there. So again, we see he's different than the typical Rosh Hashiva. Finally, before I get to the video, which is going to be relevant to what I just read, I found if any of you know the German Minhagim, you could help out here, because I found in a volume of Tshuvos called Beiros Avraham, Volume 1, Number 6, he mentions a minhag, a German minhag, and then I found another place that it's the minhag of Frankfurt, where everyone is called up to the Torah by name except for the seventh Aliyah. They just said seven come up. I know nothing about this minhag. If anyone knows anything about it, please let me know. But that relates to what we spoke about earlier. Okay, finally, I just before we get to Rabbi Eliezer Berkovits, I want to show you all a video that's been going around the Haredi internet sites all day today. Maybe it's a bit of an oxymoron, the Haredi internet sites, because they're not supposed to be on the internet, but plenty of them are. It really is relevant to what we're going to deal with Chaim Moser Grzynski, although it does have relevance also with Eliezer Berkovits, because we're going to see, if not today, after Pesach, his criticism of Das Torah. So I want to show you a video which really says a lot, I think, about this. We're going to deal in detail with more detail with Das Torah. Get to Chaim Moser Grzynski. We'll deal with Soloveitchik's eulogy to him, I mean, Das Torah today has become almost personified. If you look in newspaper articles in the Haredi press, people say things like, before I took this step, I consulted Das Torah. It's not even a, you don't say an individual, you just mention this. And in a sense, the whole notion of Das Torah is a crock, because to give you an example, just what Rabbi Zimmerman says, who's the preeminent authority of Das Torah in the Haredi world? Yashiv, who was 100 years old last week. And everyone, and if you believe the propaganda, they listen to whatever he says, he's their leader, and yet if Rabbi Yashiv came out tomorrow and said that all people should observe Atzmaut, Shiva guy should go into the army, he started supporting Hezder, his Das Torah would now be meaningless. He'd be thrown out. He'd be rejected. So this idea that Das Torah depends upon the individual is not true at all. It is true that the great individuals have a certain amount of leeway. So, for example, in Rav Shach's era, there could be no cooperation with the government in terms of Dayanim and things like that. And now, the chief rabbinate, the Haredim, want the chief rabbinate. However, when you speak about Das Torah, contrary to what the Haredim like to say, it has really nothing to do with the individual in its larger sense. There is a Das Torah that's out there, set up, let's say, by the Chazon Ish, and everyone has to be judged by that. So even their Gedolim today are judged based upon a conception that was already established many years ago. And the masses will throw out their own Gedolim if the Gedolim don't follow their Das Torah. So if you're, why is it that great Gedolim often are afraid to speak out and say things? Because they want to be recognized as Gedolim, and they know that, as I said, there's a lot of elements of nonsense in this Das Torah thing, because for all the rhetoric that they're Maran and they have Das Torah, they could be thrown out also. And I'm going to show you a video, and the reason why this was being sent out today is because all the Haredim were commenting that we see very clearly here what nonsense this whole notion of Das Torah is. At least they weren't talking about the theory, they were talking about in practice. There's been a lot of discussion about how in the Haredi world it's the Askanim, it's the people, the gatekeepers, the people who advise the rabbis, that they make the decisions. I saw 2 weeks ago when a statement came out signed by all these great figures supporting this child molester, that the great rabbis, Rabbi Yoshev and others, had to come out saying it's false, it was forged. So here you have these people go ahead and even forge the signatures of the great ones. What I'm going to show you now is a video of, it'll be in Hebrew with a little Yiddish. Maybe you'll be able to follow. If not, I'll also give you a summary at the end what it's talking about. But let me summarize briefly what's going on here. It turns out that there's a cheder in Beit Shemesh. And this family, there's a father and mother, both were widowed, and they remarried. And people do not want them in this cheder, some people, because they think they're a little, although they're Haredi, they're a little too open. That's the word. Maybe they came from America, I don't know. Now, today, the Haredi world is very different than what it used to be. If a secular group set up a town, for example, say that no Haredim allowed, have it all over the Israeli newspapers, the Haredi newspapers, how it's racist, etc. And yet in Haredi society today, they literally cannot live with non-Haredi. They set up settlements, and only Haredim are allowed in. And not only Haredim, now it's got to the point where they have their own settlements, only certain types of Haredim are allowed in, and are certainly allowed into their schools. So, and they go to Rabbi Steinman, and pay attention. When Rav Steinman starts saying he doesn't understand this, of course you have to let the child in, rather than listening to what Rabbi Steinman, who's their number two gadol after Rav Yashiv, says, the rabbi there, the Rosh Yeshiva, or the Rosh Cheder, he starts arguing with him. I mean, in a way that, and this is what all of the comments were on the various Haredi websites, that the whole idea of Das Torah is supposed to be that what the gadol says you listen to. And here he goes on and on arguing, saying, well, why should, when Simon says you have to take him to cheder, he's going on, well, why should we have to take them? You know, he can go to another cheder. It's very eye-opening. And then at the end, you see Rav Steinman get very upset. He starts speaking, and here's what he's speaking in Yiddish, that about this nonsense of the cheder, that he's from Brisk, by the way. He said he went to the cheder, and who went, and the Brisker Rav went to the cheder in Brisk, and he goes, I think he's probably, I don't think he's speaking of Revelvo, he's speaking about one of his sons. And then he starts speaking about all the people who went to this cheder. This wasn't a cheder for Haredim. This was a cheder for everyone. And he says, it didn't cause any problems. Look how we all turned out. And then he says that someone can quote a very special golf, the Derech, no matter what cheder he's in. And so then finally this guy challenges Rabbi Steinman and says, but they're not as frum as us. And Rabbi Steinman says, well, who can judge this? And he says, there's someone who says he can judge it. And Rabbi Steinman starts, really angry, says, it's gaiva. That this whoever thinks this, just think they're showing their gaiva, that they can decide who can study and who can't. So after we show this, we'll then pick up with Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. But as I says, a picture is worth 1,000 words. See here, for all this talk about respecting the Gedolim and everything like that, watch how their gadol, greatest of their Gedolim, is challenged. The sound, I think, is pretty good. We can get it going here. Shalom, can we get it going? Oh, here we go.
היה פה לפני כמה זמן סיפור, היה המנהל של החדר בבית שמש, הגיע פה לשאול את הראשי ולגבי, היה זוג שהתחתן, זה מוקשני, אלמן ואלמונה, יש שם יסיימים, יש כסף, יש בהחדר שתי ילדים שלו יסיימים, והוא התחתן עם אישה, מתחתן מחר עם אישה שמחותה, אם נדע, עם אישה שהייתה גרה בבני ברק, יש לה גם שתי יסיימים, אבא שלהם נפטר והם עוברים לבית שמש. לפי הסגנון של הילדים שלה,
אז למה יש הראשי אומר שהוא ייקח את שני הילדים באותו כיתה?
אם יש לי ברירה אחרת.
כרגע אם... השאלה אם זה אחריות של החדר.
לא יודע שאשתו מהבן, אין חילן דבר. מה? אשתו שאשתו כנען זה החילן, לא, בוא שאתה פורם לאמריקה.
אבל אלה, יש עוד כמה חידורים, יש עוד חידורים בעיר.
זה שיש את אשתו כנען זה החילן.
בגלל שאבא מתעקש?
כן, אצלו נדבר לבין הבן, לא אני, שפוס החילון.
לא, אבל זה בגלל שאבא מתעקש, זה לא בגלל שזה אבא מתעקש, אבא רוצה דווקא את החדר הזה,
עם... שיקי מין לקומוניסטים, בא לי קומוניסטים. הביאו לי שבא לי קומוניסטים, זאת לא רואה שיש.
אבל יש לי קומוניסטים, עד לכם אומרים, זה גוד
אחד קומוניסטים. אז זה היה מזרע קומוניסטים.
אני לא שומע שצריכים באמת להתחשב בזה?
הראשים, זו השאלה שלי. יש הורים שתמיד שהוא לא באותו סגנון של החיידר, ילד הזה, כי הוא בא מאימא שלו, הוא נשק לזה בסגנון כמו חיידר.
כן,
מה זה נוגע לחיידר, ראשי?
חסרי, אתם לא מכירים, אבל מכירים לנו חיילה, אבל שגור שאתה יהיה לחיילה.
יהיו את הילדים שלו
בחיילה?
שאני ריח. אבל שאני אומר על הריח, קונים כעת קרקעות.
גם לא היה, אני ריח.
אז מה עושים לנו מהסתה? אפילו שהילד הזה יכול להזיק לי בסגנון, זה לא בדיוק אותו סגנון של החיילה, והילד הזה חלש בלימודים.
הילד חיילה בלימודים, למה לא יש מינון?
בגלל שזה בסדר, אמא כנראה הייתה מבית קצת יותר מודד, מתאים יותר לחיידר יותר פתוח. זה לא שזה לא פרום, הפרום יש בו הרבה. אבל הבסדר לא פתוח, לא הסגנון של החיידר.
לא גיבוש חצי. יש עוד פסליף או פסלים ו... אתה יכול למדוד כמה...
יש אחד מההורים שאומר שהוא כן יכול למדוד.
עזוב.
תמיד יש אחד שהוא עושה...
לא זה כמה, זה הוא...
הוא עושה גייבי, צריכו לגייבי משפיזה, גם גייבי, רק גייבי, שום דבר. לא תחשוב שיהיה שמיים, גיילב, גיילב, גיילב. מי האחוז?
אפילו
שעברי
חשוב,
זה
אחוז,
זה אחוז First of all, it's not something. It's all wrong with it.
Okay, so you can see, those who could follow, the rabbi said that we can, the family, they're not as frum as everyone else. And Rabbi Steinman says, well, who can judge that? And he says, well, someone can judge it. And he says, that's gaiva. And he says, but he's a, I'll read you the exact expression. He said that he's a chashava, person who can judge him. So Rabbi Steinman replies, a grace of bal gaiva. I just think that's the whole thing we just saw here, I think, is very interesting. As I said, this has been the talk on all blogs today, the discussion of this. And yes, you're right. It's in Hebrew, and a well-pronounced Hebrew. Then it got into Yiddish. You are correct, Yisrael, exactly what you're saying. This is from 2 years ago. Okay, let us go on now. Let us return to Eliezer Berkovitz from Michli Yaakov Weinberg. A lot of interesting things I hope to get to today. I ended last class talking about this article that Berkovitz wrote that created a bit of controversy in Chicago. And someone wrote to Rabbi Michli Yaakov Weinberg asking, what to do about this, and should he sever his ties to Skokie? And I ended by saying that, I think this is where we ended, Weinberg said that he read the article and was greatly troubled, and that the article contained ideas that could not be accepted. What these ideas were, I think we'll see when we look at Berkovitz's book, Not in Heaven. But he also says, he tells us the person who wrote to him, that he had been assured by Berkovitz that this was an old article, that Berkovitz no longer was pushing these ideas, and on the contrary, he had been involved in fighting against the non-Orthodox. And that's true. Berkovitz wrote articles against Martin Buber, against Mordechai Kaplan, against Heschel. Weinberg wrote, quote, I understood from his letter that he is embarrassed by this article and wants to forget it. And Berkovitz, and Weinberg also says that he consulted Rabbi Fassman, who was head of the Rosh Hashiva in Skokie, his son Chaim Fassman, who I believe is a Rav today in Los Angeles, studied in the Mir, Leo Jung and Rabbi Samson R. Weiss, important Orthodox figures, and they all assured Weinberg that Berkovitz was doing important good work in America. In fact, I published some years ago in Hamayan a letter by Rabbi Michli Yaakov Weinberg. After someone attacks Berkovitz, Weinberg writes as follows. He says, I saw in the journal Hamaor that someone was attacking Berkovitz, and it's certain to my mind that this person doesn't even reach Berkovitz's ankles in Torah learning. And we see Weinberg's confidence in Berkovitz's halachic learning in another way. In the 1960s, Rabbi Leo Jung, the Yaguna issue was really just getting off the ground. The Yaguna problem was really just first coming to people's attention. And when I say the problem, you always had issues of Aguna, but now you had more and more women who were not going to remain Agunas. If you're Orthodox, fine, you'll remain an Aguna. But what about in the 60s, you had loads of people getting married by Orthodox rabbis, the non-observant Orthodox. And if they were stuck in a situation, they were not personally observant. They were the old-fashioned Orthodox, most of whom were not Shomer Shabbos. So, of course, they'll get a get, but if they're in a situation where they can't get a get, the husband won't give them a get, these are people who are, as I said, are not even Shomer Shabbos. Are they going to remain Agunas? Of course not. they're going to go to the Reform rabbi, or they're just going to get civilly married or something like that. So this was an enormous problem, because the divorce rates after the 50s, we're talking about the 1960s now, divorce rate starts climbing, and you have all sorts of situations where legally Jewish married women are remarrying civilly. So the question was what to do about this. And Rabbi Jung thought that Rabbi Weinberg was the only one who would have the courage to approach the task. But Weinberg, when he was, when Rabbi Jung came to him in 1965, the year before Weinberg's death, he said, or maybe it was late 64, that he did not have the strength to begin detailed investigations of the problem. And he recommended that Berkowitz be given the job. And Berkowitz wrote a book, Tanayu Venisun Baget, Conditional Marriages, Conditions in Marriage and Divorce. We're going to get back and look a little more closely at what Berkowitz's proposal was. I just want to mention now that this was after Berkowitz had made certain controversial statements. Weinberg still had confidence in his halachic learning. In fact, Weinberg publishes a responsum of his. As we mentioned last class, the responsum of the woman who needed to get in Berlin, Weinberg includes this in his 3D H. Now, Weinberg begins his letter talking about Berkowitz's article as follows. Quote, I do not believe that Dr. Berkowitz intended to uproot the oral law. He goes on to say that Berkowitz was grabbed by this new spirit in Israel that you have to bring, there's a vital need to bring halacha into line with the new state of Israel. This is a big issue. Lots of people were talking about this. It's the first time that Jews had lived independently for 2,000 years. Perhaps the Shulchan Aruch is not adequate. The Shulchan Aruch is dealing with a situation where Jews are a minority, not when Jews are in their own homeland. Shulchan Aruch, for example, always assumes that there'll be non-Jews around to do certain labors. What do you do if you're in a village in the state of Israel where there's no non-Jews? And shouldn't there be, and that's not a bad thing. There should be. Who says you have to have non-Jews around? Well, then how are you going to milk the cows? How are you going to do all sorts of things? So plenty of people, especially in the Kibbutz Hadati movement, were talking about revisiting halacha. There was a lot of sentiment about this. And Weinberg says that Berkowitz was caught up in this. These people abolished the fast days. They need to fast, even on Tisha B'Av. What do you need to fast for? That was their logic. Yes, I will get back to Bill. I will deal with that haskama, or that quasi-haskama, shortly. Weinberg follows this introduction with a lengthy letter. I'm not going to go through the letter, although you can see it online. I published it. But I'll just call attention to a few interesting things that Weinberg says in this letter, because it tells us a lot about Weinberg. And when we're going to understand Berkowitz, I think we'll see him as following Weinberg, but going one step beyond. For example, Weinberg says in this letter that there are certain things in traditional Judaism that it's possible and necessary to reform. She'efshar v'shetzarich l'taknein. And he gives some examples of where you have to have, or you could have, reforms in halacha. One of them is non-Jewish milk. Perhaps not surprised by this, because today that's pretty standard. However, when Weinberg wrote this in the 1950s, I don't know what the case was in America, but in Europe, people still kept Hal of Yisrael. And Weinberg says that if the government inspects, says that it's you're only using milk from cows, that's fine. It's interesting what Rav Henkin would say about this. We saw last class that Rav Henkin said that if you can have, you can rely on the government, which was the standard view, but if you have a hashgacha, that's even better. So I think today he probably would say that if you have an OU on milk and then you have regular milk, you have to drink the OU milk. But truthfully, according to what Weinberg is saying, you don't need any hashgachas on milk. And obviously in Europe to this day, you don't have any hashgachas on milk. You rely on the government. Why do you need Chol V'Yisrael? Chol V'Yisrael is in order so that there's no pig's milk. And if the government is inspecting it, that's reliable. Weinberg's going to say that I don't have the strength to permit this, but there's no reason why it shouldn't be permitted. Have these problems. He wasn't concerned about any of these issues. If there were, he wasn't concerned about not having enough strength. He was a posek. Weinberg was not. And Weinberg cites the Chazon Ish, so people don't realize this. The Chazon Ish also permitted milk without non-Jewish milk, that is regular milk produced by non-Jews if there's government supervision. What's the other example where Weinberg says you need to have a reform with a small r in halacha? Very relevant to time of month we are, shaving during Chol HaMoed. He says, quote, Rabbeinu Tam and the note of Yehuda permitted shaving, and the Chasam Sofer absolutely forbid it. But certainly there is a necessity to permit something which so many people already avail themselves of, and which from the standpoint of halacha and clear logic needs to be permitted, since it is the way of this generation to shave every day, and there is no one for the fear lest he enter the festival with a neglected appearance. The reason why you couldn't shave is because then in those days people only shaved every few days. People go into the festival not having shaved, knowing that they could shave during a Chol HaMoed, and that's not kavod, that's not honor for the festival. However, as others have pointed out, if you shave already every day as it is, you're going to go into the festival clean-shaven, and so what's the problem with shaving during Chol HaMoed? I think it's hard to... And then Ramosha Feinstein, of course, also agrees with this. I don't know. I live in different circles. I live in areas where people work. So that's another heter. People have to work, so they shave every day. But I think even if you go to the hotels where people are not working, I still think the practice is to be relying on Ramosha Feinstein and others, and to shave every day. However, when Yechiel Weinberg writes this, in Europe in the 1950s, that wasn't the practice. He's saying this should be the practice. There's no reason not to. But who am I? He says, his actual wording is, I'm also one. And I don't want to permit it on my own. And he goes on, talking about another issue that we've dealt with in the last few weeks. I'll read it to you. I am now involved in a question the rabbi has asked me concerning a woman who married, and after the marriage it became known that the husband had previously apostatized, that is, he had been a Christian earlier, and she ran away from him. As soon as she found out that he used to be a Christian, not that he used to be converted, but he was Jewish and he became a Christian, and now he became Jewish again. You might say, well, he's a Baal Tshuva, but she didn't think so. She ran away. She didn't want to be married to anyone who at one point in his life had been a Christian. He does not want to give her a get under any circumstances. This is a young woman, and if she listens to the prohibition of the rabbi, she will remain an aguna all life. Possibility that she won't listen. The Noda, the Yehuda, absolutely forbids releasing her without a get. But I think there are reasons to be lenient, there being a mekachtos, an error in the creation of the marriage. The Noda, the Yehuda, says that we are afraid that perhaps the man repented at the time of the marriage. However, and this is Weinberg speaking, everyone knows that no Jewish girl will marry someone who apostatized, even if he later repented in his heart, and even if he exchanged his new religion for Jesus. Therefore, the marriage was created in error. But who would dare oppose a decision by the Gaon, Rabbi Yecheskel Landau? However, if we had in our midst great sages of the level of Rishonim, it's perhaps possible that they would be lenient. Promotion never dealt with this case, but here we see Weinberg for her to avoid the marriage. He doesn't have the strength to do so, although I wonder today, is that really true today? He's speaking about in a traditional society, but today, would even an Orthodox woman, if she found out that a guy, when he was in his 20s, became a Christian and then became a Baal Tshuva, would she feel that this is such a terrible thing that she can't be married to him? And as he said, no Jewish girl will marry someone who apostatized? I don't think it's so relevant today, but I think today they'd be just very happy to find someone who's religious. Another example. A man married a woman, and it was later learned that he was completely impotent. We spoke about this case. The Chavos Yair, Rav Aryeh Chaim Bachrach, permits the marriage to be annulled. In theory, not in practice. However, the Gaon, Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, absolutely forbids it. Can it be said that there is no room for a heter? I have clear proofs that the marriage can be annulled, but I also am one of the fearful and will not under any circumstance leniently against the opinion of the Gaon or Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. Rav Moshe Feinstein had no problem. Rav Moshe Feinstein said that in such a case where an impotent man got married, it can be voided. And he goes on, Weinberg, to say that I don't mean to justify the views expressed by Dr. Berkovitz. I only want to clarify the difficulty of the situation. Weinberg points out that what Berkovitz is arguing is that you can have changes in halacha. That is correct. And Weinberg gives a list of examples of where we can change halacha. Berkovitz's only problem, Weinberg sees, is that he went too far. That's always going to be a judgment call. How far is too far? We'll come back to this. It's the old question, where do you draw the line? when do you say that you've left traditional Judaism and moved into conservative Judaism? Take some of the rabbinical assembly's responsa, remove the author, and show it to someone, and ask, could this have been written by an Orthodox rabbi? In some cases, the answer is yes. In other cases, the answer is no. In other cases, they're very clear that they reject the Shulchan Aruch, they fall back on conscience, things of that nature. But in other cases, you can tell the difference. Some of the responsa of Orthodox rabbis, if you took away the name, people might think it was a conservative rabbi writing it. So therefore, he concludes that because Berkovitz saw he went too far and he regretted his viewpoint, people should stop persecuting Berkovitz, and that his correspondent should continue supporting Skokie Yeshiva. Let me return now to the issue that Bill just mentioned, that I said that even after this letter, Weinberg tells Rabbi Jung that the only person he feels that could deal with this problem of the Aguna in modern times is Eliezer Berkovitz. Obviously, it's a bit of an exaggeration when he says the only one, though. He means, first of all, people he knows personally, those original halachic thinkers, and people who are not afraid to come up with new ideas. Berkovitz followed this up, and he wrote a well-researched book in which he suggested ways in which the Aguna problem could be solved halachically. We still have not solved the Aguna problem. The best that we were able to come up with, there's been many approaches to it, many suggestions. The best thing they were able to come up with is the prenuptial agreement, which apparently would solve the Aguna situation if people would actually sign it, because it puts severe monetary penalties over time on someone, and very few people are willing to pay these prices. Every day you have to pay, I don't know, whatever, $100 a day, $300 a day. Most people would give a get. In fact, according to the RCA based, no one who signed a prenuptial agreement has ever kept his life in Aguna. So maybe that is the solution. Berkovitz came up with other solutions. He dealt with, first of all, conditional marriages, and even marriage annulments. What is a conditional marriage? Setting up the marriage in a way that as part of the marriage at the beginning, the wife marries on the condition that if the husband can't, she accepts the marriage on a condition that the husband can't give her or won't give her the get, that let's say the Beis Din is able to write it independently. There had been suggestions like this earlier in the century, but nothing had come of it. Berkovitz also speaks about annulling marriages. This is really where Rabbi Rachman went off on, that rabbis have it in their authority in certain circumstances to actually annul marriages. That's what he goes on to explain. Originally, this was supposed to be published in a halachic yearbook. It used to come out called Noah's Journal, edited by the great scholar of Eliezer Berkovitz. And I discuss this in my book, what happened, that Kosher gets cold feet. He no longer wants to publish it. He even produces, after Weinberg's death, a letter he claims he received from Weinberg expressing his reluctance to get involved and also his regret at having written this letter of introduction, an approbation, a real approbation to Berkovitz's work. He wrote an approbation in which he said that in today's day and age, we need to look very carefully at what Berkovitz is writing. He didn't say he agreed with it in practice, but we need to look at it. Berkovitz claimed that this was a forgery, that the great Rabbi Kosher forged this letter, but Berkovitz claimed it was a forgery. The letter has never surfaced. I don't want to get into it now. I discuss it in my forthcoming book. There is a tradition of rabbis lying, saying false things if they think it will benefit the community. That is, if they think people are violating Shabbos and they're not listening to them, they can say that Rav Schechter said that this is, Rabbi Soloveitchik said that this is forbidden. It's a big dispute about this, but there are mainstream authorities who say that under certain circumstances, the rabbi is within his rights to lie, to make up halachic rulings and attribute them to great sages if he feels it's necessary. Raises enormous questions about the value of truth and tradition, and that's why this position is quite controversial. However, I only mention this because if it's true that Kosher forged this letter, and we have some evidence. I won't say it's conclusive. What's the evidence? That Kosher starts saying that he doesn't want to publish it in his journal, and telling Berkovitz that Weinberg has retracted. Berkovitz writes to Weinberg, and Weinberg writes back 3 weeks before his death. He couldn't even write. He had someone else, the local Rosh Hashiva in Montreal, Switzerland, write the letter for him, in which he says that, I don't know why Berkovitz is, why Kosher is getting cold feet. I told him that this is a great work. So I don't know. It's hard to say. Maybe Weinberg did write it. Berkovitz's photo is a forgery, and there is, in my new book, you'll see plenty of examples of rabbis who say you can do this sort of stuff, which I think from most of our standpoint, not just immoral, but really very unprofessional from a scholarly standpoint. In any event, Rabbi Kosher refused to publish it, and Mossad HaRav Kook published this book. And all I can say is that it's a great work of scholarship that appeared in the 60s. Rabbi Jung told Berkovitz that Ramosha Feinstein agreed in theory with what he wrote, but his book had absolutely no influence whatsoever. In fact, Kosher wrote a whole attack on this book after it appeared. The same Rabbi Kosher, who was all set to publish it and had read the book in manuscript, he published an attack on it. How was the fine enforced? Well, they say that it is taken to the secular court. And it's written in a way, it's a legal document that the secular court will enforce it. I don't know if anyone's actually gone with the latest prenuptial agreements to the secular court or not. The Lieberman Ketubah did the same thing. And I think in the end it was upheld in the court. But yeah, the lawyers have all examined this, but this is no different than any sort of arbitration. The husband is signing a document saying that he agrees to pay X amount of dollars as long as the get hasn't been given, and this will be upheld in the civil court. And it's not, of course, Rav Yoshev and the Haredim reject it because they say that this is undue influence, that you can't force someone to give a get, and this is sort of forcing them. But Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, numerous Dayanim from the Haredi world have all concluded that this is valid and this is no problem at all. And it's hard to imagine that had the RCA not come up with it, that this would have been possible. But of course, if the RCA comes up with it, it's going to be possible. And the RCA really didn't come up with it. If you recall the lectures on Morocco. In Morocco in the 1950s, Rav Messas and the other Gedolim of Morocco came up with the exact same agreement. And Rabbi Broy told me when I showed him the response of Rabbi Messas and what they did in the rabbinic conventions in the 1950s, that had they known about this, they wouldn't have needed to come up with what they call the Willig plan, because the Willig plan is no different than the Moroccan plan. And Rambam, you could even give someone lashes. Says you could put them in jail to give a get. So it's hard to see really what the problem is here, but the Haredi world, at least much of the Haredi world, has nothing to do with these prenuptial agreements. So you want me to read it? Yeah, Avid Service is Avid Service. I forgot if they upheld it or not. I was in Potomac, Maryland last year, a year and a half ago, and Matt Lewin told me the whole story of Avid Service because he was involved with it. Prior to that, there was a professor at University of Pennsylvania Law School named Levin. Leo, maybe was his first name. And he wrote about, from the legal standpoint, look, when Lieberman came up with his ketubah, because the conservatives did it, the Orthodox also felt they had to respond. And you can read an article by a young Rabbi Norman Lamb, I don't even think he was 40 years old at the time, in Tradition, explaining why the Orthodox can't accept the Lieberman ketubah. This is even though Rav Soloveitchik, in private conversation, so we're told, had no real halachic problems with it. And Lieberman's response to Lamb and the others were, show me one proof anywhere that there's a set text for a ketubah. If you look at historically, the ketubah can have anything you want it to say. And if you're having, before the marriage, if you're having prenuptial agreements where you're having these sort of things that the husband's going to pay kal vachomer, all the more so if it's the ketubah, which is not really inherent in the same way. I don't think today that anyone would have a problem with the Lieberman ketubah. Well, I could be wrong. Leo Levin, yes, thank you. But he was wrong, it turns out. Prabhupada. Okay, I think today the conservatives use the Leaving Ketubah, but if I'm not mistaken, they also use, at least for a time, they might have also used proposal. But let's go on. Let me just read you from, as Bill mentions, Weinberg's letter. Let me read you in just a couple sentences about Weinberg, his introduction, what he says. He says, quote, here's the question, anyone who looks at this, because many people are willing to reject Berkowitz's proposal out of hand, say, why should we change the way we've been doing marriage? Is it more important to maintain the absolute sanctity and permanence of Jewish marriages in the sense of I will betroth thee unto me forever, that's from the book of Hosea, so that even in religious circles, the purity of marital life should not suffer the slightest impairment? Or should we consider the widespread evils and hardships today of persons who cannot or will not be given their freedom from their spouses, and who nevertheless often remarry with disastrous consequences in violation of the law? In other words, do we say that in our circles this doesn't matter, because all the people in our circles are willing to give gittin, and therefore we don't change anything in the marriage because of the non-Orthodox or the not-as-Orthodox, or do we have a communal viewpoint? I think today it's obviously very different. Even in the Haredi world, you have people who get what Weinberg is setting out here are the two sides. And if you read his introduction closely, you see he really supports Berkowitz's position. This is no different in the dispute Weinberg was involved with over Shlita in Germany. Weinberg believed in trying to find a solution to stunning animals before Shlita. The Haredim in Frankfurt, the Hirshian community, said that we're not going to change this method of Shlita no matter what. We don't care what the non-Orthodox or not-so-Orthodox do. If they start eating treif meat, that's their problem. But we're going to keep things the way they used to be. We don't alter our religious practices for those whose commitment to Jewish law is not absolute. And in that case, Weinberg said, no, that we have to be concerned with everyone. And we can't just live in our little ghetto, and if we have tens of thousands of Jews who are basically observant, but if given a choice of no meat or non-kosher meat, they're going to eat non-kosher meat, then this is a time where we have to compromise on our standards a bit, if we can do it halachically, in order to look out for the wider community. It's always a dispute. In that video I just showed you, the rabbi was saying that we don't want to compromise on our cheder. The child might not fit in. The family is a little more patuach. They're a little more, might negatively affect the other children. Roy Steinman's response was, no. That's not enough of a reason to say you're not going to let the kid, if his father thinks this is the place he can learn best, let him in. This has always been a dispute, though, between the Haredim and the more non-Orthodox. Let's go on. I have a whole bunch of material here about the dispute over the document. Did Weinberg retract it or not? But I don't need to do that now. You can find it in my book. I do want to point out one more thing, though, that Berkowitz writes to Weinberg, right shortly before Weinberg's death, after Kosher told Berkowitz that Weinberg changed his mind on the Haskama and he wants to find out, he writes to him, this is what Berkowitz says in his letter. And I think from here also you get a sense of where Berkowitz was. I don't know if he would say this publicly then, in the 60s, but he certainly said it publicly years later. Listen to these words, Eliezer Berkowitz, to Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg, after describing the whole business with Kosher. For a long time, I have known these Gedolim and Tzadikim, in quotation marks. In their opinion, they are exempt from being concerned with civility, fairness, and honesty, as their intentions, for the sake of heaven. Speaking sarcastically. According to their approach, their holy purpose makes all means kosher. You should know that there is an ever-increasing number of young Orthodox rabbis who have completely given up hope that there is anything to expect from the Gedolei Torah, this orphan generation. Every day we see more clearly that we can't abandon the future and the people of Israel into their hands. God willing, and with God's help, we will follow our path according to our conscience and our strength, and they will be what they will be. This comes from a group of unpublished letters from Berkowitz to Weinberg, which I have in my possession, never yet been published. guess in the future that's something for me to do. His strength of conviction is seen in another letter he writes to Berkovitz. I mean, not Berkovitz, to Kosher. Kosher had urged him to stop with this publication of this book on marriage. And this is what Weinberg writes to Berkovitz. I'm sorry, what Berkovitz writes to Kosher. The question isn't if I am right or if you are right, but if an author who believes with all his heart that what I propose is Torah, if he is permitted to publicize his work. In this there is no doubt in my mind, and I can rely upon the Haskamah of Rabbi Weinberg. Kosher told him that even if you think you're right, the Gedolim disagree with you. Berkovitz writes back that I don't care what the Gedolim say. I also have the right to publish my ideas, and Rabbi Weinberg agrees. And he says as follows. Kosher had spoken about how the Das Torah of the Gedolim are against what you're saying, and this is what Berkovitz writes to him. Someone's probably going to extract this and put it on one of the blogs. Das Torah is the will of the rabbis when their will has no basis in halacha. I don't understand how B'nai Torah and Yirei Shamayim can declare that they themselves are gedolim, and as such their private opinions without a source or basis in Shas and Poskim or Das Torah. Forgive me if I tell you what is in my heart and in the ever-increasing hearts of many of the Orthodox rabbis of the younger generation. Das Torah is not Torah at all. It is the religious politics of the younger, older generation. That generation which is responsible for the spread of Reform and Conservative Judaism in this continent is itself destroying our world. Berkovitz says to Kosher that these rabbis who speak in terms of Das Torah, they're responsible for the spread of Reform and Conservative Judaism because of their closed-minded Judaism. Yes, it does sound like Will Greenberg is writing the script. And Berkovitz insists that he respects these rabbis, but you can't close your eyes, he says, to the harm that they are doing. His description of Das Torah, I think, continues to this day, and not the negative one, if that's not your inclination, but I think everyone has to agree that Das Torah is the will of the rabbis when there's no basis in halacha. The Aguda theoreticians have themselves said as much. They said that this comes from the fifth Shulchan Aruch, intuition, the intuitive understanding of the posek, that he determines that something is forbidden or permitted, even though he can't find explicit justification. From the modern Orthodox standpoint, and Berkovitz speaking as a modern Orthodox here, the problem was that this was always used as a tool to destroy the modern Orthodox and say that what they're doing is forbidden. And if you ask them, well, why is it forbidden, they come back with, Das Torah says it's forbidden. So basically it's used to bludgeon the modern Orthodox anytime they want to try something which could reach out to the less religious, a new approach, they're shot down because of Das Torah. Now, Das Torah is very powerful because if the opposing side said, well, you can't do this because it violates X and Y, well, then these other rabbis could respond and there could be a lachak debate. But as soon as you say it's Das Torah, there's no longer any debate. You close off all discussion because you haven't given any reason, any sources. His other point was that he doesn't know how B'nai Torah can declare that they're Gedolim, and as such, they have Das Torah. It's probably a little unfair because I don't know of any of the Aguda Gedolim who themselves have ever said, I'm a Gadol, and therefore I have Das Torah. It's always the laity, the followers who declare, and truthfully at the end of the day, and this is why I said Das Torah is a crock, because Das Torah does not rely on the Gadol, it's the followers. The followers determine that Rav Yosef has Das Torah, and they'll listen to him as long as they want to. And if he becomes too much of a Zionist, then we've had cases like this, where people have lost Das Torah, then they'll say that he's no longer. If Rav Yosef tomorrow would say that we should say, on coming up Yom HaTzmaut, we should say Hallel, all of a sudden, he no longer would have Das Torah. So it's the laity that determines, like Moshe Feinstein said in his famous interview in the New York Times. How did he become the leading posek of the generation, the posek ador? Because the people liked his answers, so they started calling him up. If all of a sudden they stopped liking his answers, they would stop calling him up. Someone's going to email me which gadol in particular am I referring to. There's a mid-level gadolim, but in terms of great gadolim, the author of the Eim HaBanim Smecha, deal with in a future class. He was a leading anti-Zionist Hungarian Rav, who for all the Hungarians had Das Torah. During the Holocaust, he becomes a Zionist. So today, he's not regarded as having any Das Torah. And there's other examples. In many of his private letters, Weinberg was just as critical as Berkowitz of the leading rabbis, the Gedolim from the traditional school. He thought that their opposition to university of education showed that they were not ready to live in the modern world, and they were creating a ghetto Judaism. But Berkowitz still speaks much harsher. Listen to another criticism of the Haredim and the Aguda Gedolim. This is from a letter he sent to Weinberg. Truthfully, to a large degree, it's just a question of tone. Berkowitz's tone is harsher. But they are really mirror images. What Weinberg is saying to Samuel Atlas and others is really the same thing Berkowitz is saying. Listen to this. These stupid ones, he calls these rabbis stupid ones, are the destroyers of Judaism in this land, that is America, just like their colleagues are destroying it in the land of Israel. Am Yisrael and Torah Yisrael need salvation against the plague of tzaddikim, tzaddikim in quotation marks. The day will come when we will be forced to respond publicly to these tzaddikim for God's sake and for the sake of Judaism. Do not fear, he says this to Weinberg, do not fear. I have no part in disputes and no time for them. But the day will come, and God willing, we will follow our own path without relying on these Gedolei HaTorah. This is indeed the requirement of the hour, to save and revive Judaism in the world. Hatzil Achayot Tayadut Ba'olam. He's talking in the 1950s and 1960s. Remember what Orthodoxy is. Orthodoxy is, there's a lot of lack of confidence in Orthodoxy. Orthodoxy is on the way out. Marshall Square, the sociologist, can predict that Orthodoxy is a case study of institutional decline. All the synagogues are getting rid of mechitzas. People who go to the Orthodox synagogues, their children are associating with conservative movement. How to make Orthodoxy appealing? Well, people like Emanuel Rachman and Yeshiva University and Eliezer Berkowitz, they had ideas. They saw the old-time rabbis as leading Judaism into destruction. Of course, come back 20 years later, and it's the old-time Judaism that's having a revival and even overtaking the more modern Judaism. That's because of events that happened in the 1970s and 80s, the turn to fundamentalist religion. Also, we can't forget America, you know, the welfare state and what that was offering, all sorts of things. But this is unimaginable in the 1960s. In the 1950s, Rabbi Soloveitchik, we have a tape of him saying this. He's talking about how he knew real Hasidus in Warsaw, and there's no Hasidus in America. And someone gets up, and you can hear on the tape in protest, no, there are Hasidim, and there is Hasidus in America. And Rabbi Soloveitchik poo-poos him and says, it's not true, it's impossible, and there will never be real Hasidus in America. Go forward 40 years, and you have Satmar, and you have Babov, and Bells, and all these groups. You have real Hasidus. It was unimaginable to Rabbi Soloveitchik that you could recreate Satmar in America. The 1950s was an era, this was before multiculturalism, it was an era of assimilation, where it was... you're supposed to assimilate into the majority culture. And Orthodox rabbis were struggling to keep people observant in that era. And Hirsch's term, Derech Eretz, was thought to be the only way to go. Think that we could have a Judaism like we have today? He thought that was something from the past. But this is why Berkowitz is speaking with such emotion, because he sees what's happening to Orthodoxy, and he blames the right wing. See what Ira says. That's an interesting point you say. I mean, the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, so if you're on a Moetzes called itself Gedolei HaTorah, in Rav Avadia Yosef, they don't call it that. They call it the Moetzes of the Chachmei HaTorah. They don't call it Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. But it's a bit of I think it's going out a little too far, because there certainly have been great Gedolim who have been on that. There's a difference between knowing you're a Gadol, I think, and saying you're a Gadol. Great scholars know that they're Gedolim. They know it. And if someone else wants to call it that, that's up to them. However, if they call themselves it, If they refer to themselves that way, then that's going a little too far. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that he was the leader, and he was the greatest. When it says that he was humble, it's the fact that he knew how great he was, and he's still humble. Not that he didn't know how his greatness. So I don't know, but what else could you have called the Moses Gedolia Torah? But it's a good point. Certainly, I would agree with that person that if someone were to call himself a gadol, include himself in that category, then that's a problem. Saw the problem already with the Ritbaz, the book he published. I said that hopefully it was published by someone else, in which it refers to him on the title page with such grandiose descriptions. Now, returning to Berkowitz. Although Berkowitz believes that he was following in Weinberg's path, we do know, and we do have evidence, that the student went further than the teacher. And I read it to you last week, that in the introduction of Not in Heaven, he says, don't think that I'm representing Weinberg. I'm representing myself. But he's following what he had been taught from Weinberg. We can't forget that to the day he died, Weinberg had confidence in Berkowitz, which is why he asked him to write this work. One other thing which I didn't publish when I published the letter of Weinberg in the Adah Journal, I kept to the substantive material. I didn't publish this paragraph, which I'm going to read you now, which gives Weinberg's description of Berkowitz. Berkowitz is by nature an effervescent thinker, and he was grabbed by Yeshaya Leibovitz's ideas. In a future class, we'll deal with Yeshaya Leibovitz. But Yeshaya Leibovitz spoke about revitalizing halacha, that the Shulchan Aruch is a gullus halacha. It's a halacha that reflects the diaspora, and we need a new halacha. I praise him that he did not hide this in his heart, but revealed what he was thinking. Yet he stumbled and spoke falsely. I am sure that his article arose at a time of spiritual crisis and spiritual loss. Now, Berkowitz remains at the Skokie Hebrew Theological College until he goes on Aliyah in 1976. While there, he founds a synagogue, which is still in existence in Skokie, but it was not an easy tenure. He had to deal with conflicts with the Rebbein there, the Rosh Yeshiva. Today, Berkowitz is persona non grata at the Skokie Yeshiva, even though from 1958 to 1976, he was their most famous faculty member, and he was really their pride. See how much of their pride he was in just a few minutes when it came down to him and someone else who was given the boot. Now, a few years ago, the Skokie Yeshiva has a journal. I don't know if it's an annual. It's a journal. It comes out occasionally. And a few years ago, one of the teachers, his name is Rabbi Chaim Tursky, published a review of Berkowitz's Not in Heaven. This is a review published 20 years after the book appeared. Why does anyone publish a review of something 20 years later? Well, only because you really want to trash it. And he really blasted it. The book itself is a very rare book, although there now, if you go on Amazon, you can get it for like $100. It's a short little book. They are reprinting it in Israel at the Chazoni, David Chazoni, who's involved with the magazine Azure and that institute, Shalem Institute. They're going to be reprinting it. I mean, now, it's really funny because here Berkowitz was such an important person. In this article, it's only referred to as Dr. Berkowitz, not Rabbi, but his name is misspelled. It's spelled Berkowitz, W-I-T-Z, when his name is Berkowitz, V-I-T-S, the most prominent faculty member of the Skokie Yeshiva 25 years after he leaves. The person, not only the person writing the article, but all the people who read it over the editors, no one even knows how to spell Berkowitz's name. And we have other examples like this, where people would not be welcome at their own shul. Chicago, if you know what happened, the Skokie Yeshiva is going through a lot of problems. It doesn't really know what to be. It doesn't want to be modern Orthodox, but Haredi, well, you already have Haredi institutes in Chicago. Where is it going to be? It really hasn't been able to find itself, but it's nowhere near what it used to be. So therefore, Berkowitz would not even be permitted to speak there today. And we have other examples of this. Let me give you some examples I think you'll find interesting of where people would not even be welcome at their own shuls. There's a shul, famous shul, called Shari Tefillah in Lawrence. It used to be in Far Rockaway. This was Rabbi Emanuel Rachman's old shul. This was also my in-laws. That's where they were married, my mother-in-law and father-in-law, by Rabbi Rachman, and my wife's grandparents were longtime members of the shul from Far Rockaway, Shari Tefila. Those days, so many of those people were non-observant Orthodox. Following him, and today, of course, Rabbi Rackman wouldn't even be permitted in there. They wouldn't even answer to his Kaddish. Following him was another rabbi, one of Rabbi Soloveitchik's early and closest students, Rabbi Walter Wurzburger. To this day, Shari Tefila in Lawrence has a Walter Wurzburger memorial talk. Wurzburger, one of the great intellectuals. Alan Brill has a very nice essay on Walter Wurzburger for those who want to read it. I'm sure many people listening knew Rabbi Wurzburger. I don't know who they had last year, but 2 or 3 years ago they had Rabbi Yisachar Friend. Rabbi Brill forwarded this announcement to me because he wanted to show this to me, that it's not a joke. Not taking anything away from Rabbi Friend, who has a lot to offer, but again, this was a Rabbi Walter Wurzburger memorial talk. It's unbelievable that for a memorial talk, which often you want to reflect the sentiment of the person you're honoring, that you would have Rabbi Yisachar Friend. Even more unbelievable is that I tell you that today, Shari Tefila in Far Rockaway, in Lawrence, would not even allow Rabbi Walter Wurzburger to give the Walter Wurzburger memorial address. They won't permit anyone whose ideology was like Wurzburger to give the memorial address for him. I mean, a few months ago, they had the Rebbe of Toldos Aharon, most extreme of the extreme anti-Zionist Hasidim, come and speak there. But they won't let Wurzburger's type of people speak there. And let me just give you a list of scholars and residents they've had. Again, I don't mean this to criticize any of the people there, just to show you how we have a situation here where a shul, the two people who built this show up, Rackman and Wurzburger, neither of them would be welcome as speakers in their own show. Here's the list of the scholars in residence for the last, whatever, 7, 8 years. Rabbi David Ordman, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, or Tates, Rabbi Mordechai Becher, Rabbi Herschel Schechter, Rabbi David Bleich, Rabbi Moshe Eisenman, Rabbi Pesach Kron, Rabbi Hanoch Teller. None of these people, even the ones associated with YU, are identified with the vision of Judaism of Walter Wurzburger, which was Dim Derech Eretz, Torah and Secular Knowledge. Wurzburger was a PhD in philosophy from Harvard. It's just a very different type of Judaism than the Judaism that Walter Wurzburger advocated when he was speaking there. The two YU speakers, Rav Schechter and Bleich, they come to speak about halacha. They're halachic spokesmen. So, and they're the great halachic teachers of the modern orthodoxy and the Yeshiva University orthodoxy. None of the others who are speaking on issues of, I guess you call it, hashkafa, ideology, Ordman, Tatz, Becher, Eisenman, Krohn, Teller, none of them are associated with the mainstream, even Yeshiva University world. These are all on the right wing. So not a Torah Mata type among them. And in fact, and I'll conclude with this, in 2002, there was a Berkovitz conference in Chicago. He still has admirers there. And they wanted to have a conference. They asked me to speak. I spoke on Weinberg and Berkovitz, their relationship. I quoted these letters. I give a lot of credit to Rabbi Weinreb from the OU. He came and he spoke there about Berkovitz. It was held at the synagogue, the synagogue Berkovitz founded, because Skokie would not have it. They would not. You could not have a memorial conference in memory of Berkovitz at the Skokie Yeshiva. Yet, there was a time when he was so important to the administration, as I said, that if it came time to him or one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, they chose him over the Rosh Yeshiva. And I see we're going to have to stop here. And when we meet after Pesach, God willing, we will pick up right with this terrible dispute that broke out publicly in front of the students and others, which led to the firing of Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman. There's plenty of people today who still remember it. So with this, I'm going to conclude and say again, this has been a very nice semester. Enjoyed it very much. Thank you, as always, for the comments or questions that you've sent me. I've learned a lot from all of them, including many who I didn't have time to mention here. I responded privately. Next semester, we'll probably have 2 more classes on Berkovitz, in which we'll finish up with his biography and also his halachic vision. I want to go into his halachic vision as seen in 2 books, God in Heaven and Jewish Woman in Time and Torah, and then speak about his understanding of post-Holocaust theology, faith after the Holocaust, where he's really had enormous impact. There's a whole secondary literature written about him, probably 10 articles or so, dealing with Berkovitz's ideas. We're going to deal mostly with what he says, not with different interpretations. And after that, I'm going to move on to Rav Moser Grudzinski, and I think for the rest of the semester, we'll deal with a Sephardic rabbi, Eliyahu ben Amozig, very fascinating Italian rabbi who has a lot to say. And if we have time, Rav Chacham, Rabbi Yosef Masas, I think we'll finish up with him if we get to him, or maybe I do want to do Rav Aaron Cutler. Other figures I want to get to. But that's what we're looking at. So now let me just take some questions before we break for Pesach. Yes, no, this doesn't relate, right? Berkovitz's proposals in the 60s. What happened was in the 1930s you had the Epstein proposal. And then there was another rabbi who wrote a book who had his own proposal, and that's the Haskama you're referring to there. I forget the name of the book, but in the annual Yeshurin, there are two lengthy articles all about Tanai, about conditional marriages. They go into great detail about Berkovitz's. They deal with every conditional marriage that ever was suggested. Rabbi Dano suggested one. You had French rabbis. You had the rabbis of Constantinople. You had Rabbi Epstein from the conservative movement. And in there, they discuss this book that you're referring to and Chaim Moser and Rav Cook's back and forth. Since you mentioned Rav Cook, Louis Epstein claims that Rav Cook gave him oral approval for what he said, verbal approval. And and Rav Cook wrote a letter denying that. And what could Epstein do but say that Rav Cook, since he didn't write it down, he probably didn't remember it. But as soon as Rav Cook wrote that, Rav Chaim Moser said, see, this shows that Epstein's a liar. I find it hard to believe that Epstein is a liar. There probably was a misunderstanding between what Rav Cook said. Now, with the Epstein proposal, there was a whole book called Ain Tanai B'Nisuin. All the American rabbis, the American Orthodox rabbis, not Ain Tanai B'Nisuin, called L'Dor HaCharon, where all the American rabbis, even many European rabbis, including Rav Chaim Moser, condemn any alteration of the traditional marriage. It was because of that Rav Henkin, who put forth his own proposal, backtracked. But in the late 19th century, when the French rabbis came up with their own proposal, then there was a book called Ain Tanai B'Nisuin. I'm sure you can find both of them online now, in which the rabbis in the 19th century affirmed that you cannot have any changes. So then why, how does Berkovitz feel he can go and offer something new when these other rabbis were shot down? First of all, Berkovitz says that the times have changed, the situation is so much more dire today, number one. And number two, his proposal, and this is what they all say, is different than the other proposals. That is, the reason the other proposals had to be rejected is not the reason his proposal needs to be rejected. I didn't get into the details here because these are getting into the halachic nitty-gritty, whereas the opponents said that there's really no difference, that any time you have a condition, that is, when a man and a woman get married, on the condition that if the husband doesn't do this or that, the basin will be able to do it, the condition is voided. As soon as the man and wife are living happily, the condition is automatically voided. Yeah. That would be the one, the French one, I'm sure. Yeah, I'll wait a few, I see more people typing here. Someone asked me who came before Rabbi Zimmerman. The answer is Rabbi Kreisworth. He was a very young person in his 40s. He was rabbi at Head Rosh Yeshiva at Skokie, from, I think, 47 to 53, and then he goes to Antwerp, and he's the rabbi in Belgium, passing some 40 years later. When Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg was asked to come to Skokie, Rabbi Kreisworth was the big man there, and that's what Rabbi Weinberg thought, that how could he become Rosh Yeshiva in a place where the big man is 30 years younger than him? That he didn't think was kavod, as he says, not for himself, but for his students and the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. Rabbi Kreisworth is also a great rabbi. Well, Rachman doesn't really have conditional marriages, Bill. Thank you for pointing that out. It'd be nice to have someone like Rabbi Jachter give a whole class on Torah in Motion about the different proposals. But Rachman doesn't have conditional marriages. Rachman is all about annulling on the assumption that the people who get married, the woman who gets married, was unaware of certain information. Now, Berkovitz speaks about this. He speaks about annulling marriages, we saw last week. However, he never spoke about the idea that that Rackham was speaking about, that 20 years after the fact, let's say the marriage becomes a difficult marriage and the husband, either the husband could become a physical abuser or a mental abuser. He doesn't, as far as Rackham was concerned, the fact that the husband wouldn't give a get shows that he's a cruel person, and this cruelty was there from day one. Had the wife known about it, she never would have married him. That makes a mekach tos. That's a real stretch, and there's no evidence that Berkovitz would have gone along with this. Rabbi Shalom Messas is very, very prepared to annul marriages. He dealt with a case where a woman married a man, and then she finds out afterwards that maybe he had syphilis or something like that, but something that normally would allow the marriage to be voided. But she was willing to live with it, and she lived with it for a year, and they had a child, and then all of a sudden she wants to get divorced, and she gives that as the reason. He says that you can't have a mekach tos. If a person has been married for a year or 2 years, they've had a family life, that shows that they accept the flaw, the defect. The whole notion of a mekach tos is that when you get married, you find out about something, you find out something about the person, and had you known this, you never would have been married. Rackman's reply is that that's not an objection, because Rav Messas wrote against any proposal that you can marry 10 years and get divorced. But Rabbi Rackman said, this is a different situation. It's not like they got married and the woman knew about this and lived with him for 10 years. She only learns about his cruelty after they decide to get divorced. So she didn't know about it. But I still think it's a real stretch, because who says the man had this? I only spoke to Rackman a few times, and one of the times I asked him about this. I said, who says that shows an inherent tendency to be wicked, to be evil? Maybe the only reason the husband's being a jerk and not giving her the get is because he hates her. Because now they're in this fight, and that's why he's not doing it. But before, he loved her, so he had no interest in doing that. But Rackman's point was that if you ask psychologists, they will tell you that this tendency was there. The fact that he loved her is neither here nor there, because the tendency was there. That is, this evil nature of his was there from the beginning. It's not just being created now because he hates her. It's coming to the surface now because he hates her. And since he has this, and according to Rabbi Rackman, this explains why none of the Gedolim of the previous generation ever offered this proposal. Because he says it's only with modern psychology do we now know that people have this defect. And as far as Rackman was concerned, this is no different than a physical defect. Just like if you get married and you find out a year later that the person you married had AIDS or something like that, then marriage is voided. You can void the marriage. Everyone today would agree with that. It's no different. You find out a year later, 5 years later, that he has this terrible temper, or is the fact that he doesn't give the get, he refuses to, is itself proof that he has this evil nature, and you never would have married someone with this evil nature. That was his argument. In America, never accepted this argument. And Berkovitz never dealt with this, because he had already passed on by the time this was put forward. Yeah, okay. Wait another minute or so. If else typing, I see CYL is typing.
Thank you.
For those of you who will be joining us next semester, we keep trying to build up the popularity, so tell everyone you know. I see two more people typing, so let me just hold on for another 2 minutes. What to say? When I said typing, I'm not sure if you're just typing on your computer, if you're typing to send me a message or not. Okay, well, nothing's appearing on the screen, so my email, I'll write it down right now. And Bill Gewirtz, I look forward to reading your future material on the times of Shabbos and everything else. Okay, good. Okay, then let me wish everyone Chag Kosher V'Sameach, wherever you're going. They'll hopefully resume. I think it's April 26th. And again, one just more time, thank you to everyone for your questions, your comments. And it says you're typing CYL. I can just thank you for so much you sent to me offline, CYL. But in any event, to everyone, as I said, a chag kosher v'sameach.